Okay, and I'm Juan Maldacena from the Institute for Advanced Studies, and I work on IDSCFT and various applications. Okay, so this is a workshop on amplitudes, and this talk will consist of three different parts. They are somewhat connected to amplitudes, but not to amplitudes in gauge theories, at least not yet. But to amplitudes in gravity. In particular, they are all related to amplitudes in gravity in the Sitter space. Now, you all know that amplitudes are overlaps. So there is some initial state that could be a certain number of gluons and some outgoing states, which are a certain other number of gluons. And many of you here work on amplitudes in n equal to 4 super Young mils and compute these things, and you compute these things at tree level, one loop, two loops, etc. But we know that these are infrared diversion. So what do we mean when we say we compute these amplitudes? What do we mean when we say we compute the one loop amplitude or two loop amplitudes? Well, something we know is that amplitudes, it's true that they're infrared diversion, but if you introduce an infrared regulator and you then remove it, all the pieces that diverge have a very simple structure and can be removed in an organized way. So it's very similar to what happens when you renormalize operators in the ultraviolet, that you can remove all the divergences up and you can absorb them all in a few constants. For amplitudes, this, at least for planar in the particular case of. Well, in general, for amplitudes, you get terms that involve a log squared, and then there are some terms linear in the log, and then there is something that we can call a renormalized amplitude. And we are used to the fact that this is a well-defined mathematical object, and we are all trying to compute them in n equal to 4, for example. Okay. On the other hand, these objects we compute are all zero, because in the limit that we remove the regulator, we actually get zero. Now, I would like to say that this is very similar. Well, sorry, one more point. If you really want to compute something physical, like inclusive some jet cross-section or something like that, like many of you here who work on QCD are computing, you might compute these amplitudes as an intermediate step, but then you would sum over all final states, and then these divergences will disappear. Okay. Now, the point I would like to make is that these amplitudes are very similar to computing the wave function of the universe in this respect of the Sitter space with a fixed boundary metric in the future. So if you imagine that you have a cosmology where we have time, and I'm going to always talk about conformal time, so we have some space which is a solution of Einstein's equations with constant cosmological constant. So we are taking an action, which is the action of Einstein gravity, m Planck square, square root of g, r minus 2 lambda. This could be a model for inflation. For inflation, really, you need to add some extra fields. But I'm going to first talk about the case of just pure metric. And we take a metric, which in the future could be the Minkowski metric plus some small fluctuations. And something we can calculate is the wave function for the small fluctuations. Or we could say that we are calculating really perturbatively the wave function of this three metric that appears here. So this is a three-dimensional metric on a three-dimensional slice. Here we have chosen a gauge. We have fixed the zero, zero component of the metric and the zero I components of the metric to special values. And we just consider the wave function of the universe as a function of a metric on a three-dimensional slice. And here, I'm not talking about the wave function of the zero mode, but the wave function of the small fluctuations. It's a perfectly well-defined object perturbatively, and it's what we normally calculate when we consider the generation of fluctuations from inflation. So, I mean, the usual way this is described is, you go eta going to minus infinity is the very far past, is when the universe was very small, and eta going to zero is when the universe is very big. And then in this case, we have quantum fluctuations that become very big. They get to be outside the horizon. And so if we analyze what the metric is at late times, so we pick a metric. In general, the metric will be a function of eta. And if we look at solutions of the classical equations, they have the property that when they go to the future, if you keep a wavelength which is fixed in these x coordinates, its time dependence will disappear at late times. So, okay, so now this wave function can be computed and is sometimes called the Bunch-Davis wave. It's nothing else than the Bunch-Davis. Well, we can call this the Bunch-Davis wave function, or we could say this is an overlap between the state with fixed metric, fixed three-dimensional metric, times the Bunch-Davis wave function. So there's the Bunch-Davis wave function, which is what we compute using perturbation theory, or sometimes it's called Hartle-Hawking also. And then we calculate the overlap of that Bunch-Davis with a state with a fixed metric. This is the same as computing the position, the wave function in position space. I'm not saying anything. Yeah, that's in principle what should be done. Of course, that integral will not converge if you do it. But the semi-classical approximation to this wave function consists in taking some fixed metric in the future, some G3, and then solving the classical equations of this action with the so-called Bunch-Davis boundary conditions, where in the very far past, let's say for a mode with fixed Fourier mode, fixed Fourier Fourier momentum in the spatial directions, it has an A e to the I k eta. So we fix the frequency in the very far past of the waves, so of all the waves in the very far past, positive frequency condition. That amounts to choosing the vacuum, the ordinary Minkowski vacuum for an observer who lives at very early time and is considering a mode of wavelength which is much smaller than the vacuum. All this is standard stuff, and I'm just stating it in a way that might not, well, maybe it's familiar to everybody. So the claim is that this is equal to the to just the classic, the Einstein action evaluated on a classical, this is the Einstein action evaluated on a classical solution, which depends on eta and x, and is such that g at eta equal to 0, x is that 3 metric that we are interested in, and g has this boundary condition when eta goes to minus infinity. Okay, so that's one way to evaluate the to describe what this wave function is. And this is the so-called tree-level approximation to the wave function. So this includes, if you take this action, you expand it to only quadratic order, put here the solution to quadratic order, you'll get the ordinary Gaussian approximation to the wave function. And just for completeness, maybe I should say what that is. So in the Gaussian approximation, Gaussian means we expand it to quadratic order the Einstein action around the flat, the uniform, the Sitter metric. So if G is 1 or delta j, that's the Sitter space, and we just expand to quadratic order, we get the Gaussian approximation, and that's just simply, well, there is always the M Planck, which multiplies everything, and the other scale is given by the Hubble scale, which is the overall radius appearing in this metric. I didn't write it here, but we can multiply by an overall constant. And of course, that constant is determined by the value of the cosmological constant. But so the only parameter really we have in the game is M Planck over H squared. Any solution with those conditions we are imposing here will have an M squared multiplying everything. And by dimensional reasons, it should be an M squared over M Planck over H squared. And so that will always multiply the classical action, no matter whether it's the Gaussian approximation or the full three-level answer. But well, in the particular case of the Gaussian approximation, we'll have a quadratic function of this small fluctuation. which in Fourier space we can just write as H of k, H of minus k, for example. K cubed, we could have integral d3k. And these factors of k cubed and so on come from simply from scale invariant. So the fact that this wave function should be invariant and there be scalings of coordinates. So that's a classical isometry of the Sitter space. And it's a symmetry of the wave function. And it's the statement that inflation during the Sitter period produces a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations. OK, so that was the quadratic approximation. OK, very good. Now, ordinarily, this result is not expressed in this way. It's normally expressed as an expectation value of the metric in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, right? So it's normally this would be, we write this as Bunch-Davis, HH Bunch-Davis. And this is just simply taking this wave function and integrating over all possible metrics of, well, the square of this, right, this psi squared. And then we put this HH. And so this is a Gaussian. So we do this Gaussian integral. And what we will get is the inverse of this coefficient here, right? So this is, right? It's just an ordinary Gaussian integral. If we want the expectation value of this, so divided by the same thing but without the H's, we'll just get 1 over that. So we get H squared. And this is probably the most familiar way of writing this. Now, so the point of saying this is, well, first of all, that this usual statement is completely equivalent to this statement in terms of the Gaussian wave function. That's a trivial transformation of variables. And furthermore, that if we were to evaluate corrections to this that correspond to tree diagrams in the bulk, it will be also all of these things would be completely equivalent and will be completely equivalent to solving the classical Einstein equations with those boundary conditions. In other words, so this, let me mention some words about the diagrams. You can view this as evaluating a diagram which is roughly like this. Here I'm not going to distinguish between, well, we could distinguish between the diagram that evaluates HH with the diagrams that evaluate the wave functions or derivatives of the wave functions with respect to the metric. Well, maybe I should. Well, so we're evaluating diagrams which could be of this form. So all possible tree diagrams of Einstein's theory. Okay, and all, of course, as we are used to, evaluating tree diagrams corresponds to solving the classical equations with particular positive frequency boundary conditions. Okay. Now, I lied a little bit when I said that the solution of Einstein's action on this metric will give you exactly that. Actually, if you really do it, you will get that this is equal to, well, that function times, so let's say, well, let me call it psi r, times a factor which, plus some factors m r squared times something of this form. So the integral of the three-dimensional metric plus the integral of the three-dimensional metric on the three-dimensional slice times the curvature of the three-dimensional slice. So that's really the full answer that you get. And this full answer is actually not scale invariant. So because if you, it's not invariant under a Weyl-Ri scaling of the metric because these factors will grow as the metric grows in the future. But these are local terms. They are familiar from ADS-50. The same terms arise in ADS. And they, in the case of DS, when you solve the classical action, you get these terms with an I in front. But they do not contribute to the expectation values, because when we take the modulus square of the wave function, they just simply drop out. OK, very good. OK, now one, so that's what you get. And we can view this as a solution of with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in a particular gauge. And then this wave function obeys two constraints. One is the Hamiltonian constraint and the reparametrization constraint. The reparametrization constraint simply saying that this should be a function that is reparametrization invariant of the three metric. And the Hamiltonian constraint translates into the statement that this quantity here is invariant until wild rescalings of the metric, so that it has this extra property. Okay. So viewed as a function of the three metric, this is completely invariant under an overall rescaling of the metric. The same statements are true in ADS, and this statement, of course, is consistent with the idea that this wave function can be viewed as the partition function of a three-dimensional conformal field theory. So these two statements are consistent with the statement that this as a function of a three-dimensional metric. So let's say in the case of ADS, where the kinematics is very similar, this can be viewed as the partition function of ADS. Sorry, the partition function of some CFT that we'll have to find in principle for each theory in the bulk as a function of the three-dimensional metric. Okay. The C comes from precisely this fact that this invariant under Weyl transformations. Now, in fact, there is a close connection between the de Sitter and anti-de Sitter calculations. And that can be made more manifest by looking at, look at these formulas, and if you make the replacement eta to IC, okay, then the metric that was written over there goes to dc squared plus dx squared over c squared up to an overall minus sign. Okay. So this is what the new metric is, equal to minus all this. So this is almost the metric of ADS, except for an overall minus sign. But I told you there was some overall radius of the Sitter square here. And if we change the radius of the Sitter square to minus the radius of ADS squared, then we get the ADS metric. So the statement is that this results, this is a statement not about any relation to a CFT yet. So let me erase this for a moment. This was some ADS comment. Let me erase this for a moment. This wave function that is being calculated here is exactly the same as the one we would calculate in ADS, in an ADS pure gravity theory, where we simply change in one of these coordinates. And in fact, this change here is quite physical because this condition, in order to really implement this condition in practice, when you do a perturbative calculation, what you do is you will get integrals, and these integrals will go from 0 to minus infinity when you do a practical calculation. And you find that in order to make them convergent, you have to change the contour of integration in eta. You have to rotate it a little bit into the imaginary direction in such a way as to make this decay. And well, if you're going to rotate it a little bit, let's just rotate it completely. And we can rotate it the full way. And then this condition just becomes the condition that things decay at infinity. Okay. And that's precisely the condition we would impose if we were doing the same calculation, but in ADS. Now, let me state this also in another way, which is that if we think in terms of expectation values, which is the usual, which is one way we could think about doing calculations in the Sitter, then the result of doing these calculations is an analytic continuation from the sphere. So this you get by analytic continuation from S4, so you start from doing computations on S4 and a field theory on S4, then you can get this guys by analytic continuation. And this is true for any interacting field theory in the Sitter space. The same is true for when you think in terms of the wave function, but now this is an analytic continuation from Euclidean ADS. Sometimes this is also known as hyperbolic space. In fact, of course, hyperbolic space was before Euclidean ideas. But, so if you are interested in calculating the wave function, it's convenient to do this continuation in this way. And recently, Harlow and Stanford from Stanford developed this a bit further. Okay, so that was a side comment. So there is this analytic continuation. Okay, so that's one comment. Now, let's discuss one loop correction. So everything that I've said so far was said before in the literature by various people. And now, one observation is that if we compute the wave function of the universe, it is true that, and if you impose these boundary conditions, and we now compute it, for example, to one loop, there is one new feature that you get at one loop, which is that we are calculating the one loop diagram with fixed boundary conditions in the future for the metric. And what you get is you will get a new counter term here that will be real. And the physics of that counter term is simply that it's unprobable to have a universe without fluctuations. So the universe wants to have fluctuations. And if you put the boundary conditions that, let's say, the metric is, for example, uniform, that there are no fluctuations, then you'll get the probability that it's very small. So it's very similar to what we had over here. Okay, that's why I started with this. Okay, identical to this, the same physics and the same reason that we have that suppression will have a suppression at one loop, and will. I mean, these calculations were also done in literature, maybe sometimes not with exactly this interpretation. In fact, for example, Polyakov did this one-loop diagram and interpreted this as a decay of the Sitter space. I'm just simply saying this is exactly what you expect if you have this thing proportional to m Planck squared, and then there is a piece that is independent of m Planck because it's a one-loop diagram that diverges when you remove the cutoff, so it will have a piece which is proportional to the square root of the 3 metric, and then also a piece involving the scalar curvature, subleading piece, and then of course we'll have terms that are completely conformal invariant. But
why are you talking about graviton nuclear or massive fields? Because I think
Polyakov. Yeah, Polyakov only talked about massive fields, and it is really easier to understand why, or the explicit form. So for massive fields, this factor I'm talking about, if you compute it explicitly with some cutoff in eta and so on, you get something that goes like e to the 1 over, let's say, the eta cutoff you put cube times some logarithm of 1 e to the minus h mass, right? Something roughly like this. So this factor can be interpreted as this piece here. Well, this can be rewritten as 1 minus e to the minus h t, right? Hm. Sorry, m over h. M over h. Yeah, is this to some power, which is 1 over eta c? And this is the number of Hubble volumes we have at this cutoff. And it is just simply saying that e to the minus mht is the probability of producing one particle. This is the probability of producing no particle. And that's the suppression factor that we get. Right? Of course, once we look at a physical thing where we allow this particle to be produced, and we sum over all final states, we sum over the state that contains, let's say, one particular metric or some other particular metric, we sum over all of them, this will disappear. At least certainly, this will disappear. This we know at one loop that it will disappear. Now, you get a very similar factor for massless gravitons. You can also do the calculation for massless gravitons, and it's not as obvious as this situation, but you get some log of eta here and so on. Exactly, yeah. So you get something here which is real. It has a minus, so this whole thing, this is negative because this thing is positive. So it has an overall minus sign. It's a suppression factor. It's exactly the same physics as that. totally equivalent. Right. What? Yep. Well, you are forbidding the creation of something that wants to be created, right? In this case, you want to create soft gluons. In this case, you want to create gravitons. Yeah, so the translation, if you wish, is low energy gluons here are short, very short wavelength gravitons that were created at late times. So it is quite closely related, and not for, I mean, you can choose coordinates where a collision happens. You can choose coordinates for a collision where they are basically sort of like expanding the Sitter coordinates, and well, that looks like the Sitter space, and so there's a fairly close connection between the two things. It's not totally unrelated. And it's useful to have this intuition to think about it this way. So, okay, now you can ask why would I bother to compute this thing that is that goes to zero? Why don't I compute directly the physical thing, right? So in this particular case, well, maybe we can compute this or whatever technique we can use. If there is a technique that allows us to calculate this as a first step, that's good, right? Now, in the case of this of the Sitter space, it could be that there might be a technique that allows us to compute this this as a function of the metric, because it might be that in the same way as we have for ADS, there might be actually a CCFT for the case of the Sitter. We don't know whether there is one or not, but there might be. Now there have been some objections to the possibility of having the Sitter CFT, but this is the statement of the Sitter CFT. I think this should be the correct statement. Various other statements were similar looking, but not exactly this, were made in literature before. And so if you think about this statement, and if you think that this should be the statement, then many of the objections that were made to the CFT disappear. So where were the objections? Well, this would be, yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. Okay, so what were the objections? So the objections, well, one objection is that the Sitter is a thermal system, and so there will be always thermal fluctuations. And when you try to define a correlation function, so for example, the stress tensor correlation function, which involves calculating the metric here in the very far future and correlating it with the metric here in the very far future, you will have trouble, because as you go here, the metric will start fluctuating, and you will not be able to measure the value of the metric in order to calculate the two-point function. This was an argument that was given in a paper by Kleban, Saskin, and I think it was Dyson, but maybe it was someone else. Okay, so I was going to look at these references from 1 to 3, but I'm sorry. okay, so but however, here we don't have this problem, because that problem only arose because you were summing all final states, because you were allowing the metric to fluctuate. But if you set these boundary conditions where the metric is fixed in the future, let's say the metric had some big fluctuation like that, but no other fluctuations at shorter distances. That's what we are computing. So we are forbidding by hand these small fluctuations, and because of that, when we go in the future, the metric will be actually well-defined, and we won't have those fluctuations. That was one objection. There is another objection which says that the Sitter space always decays in string theory. Okay, in string theory, whenever we have the Sitter space, we expect it to decay. But again, here we are also assuming that the space did not decay. So we are computing properties of the part of the special case where the space did not decay. It's completely analogous to the amplitude situation that I raised here, where you would say, well, the physical thing is that you'll produce extra particles. Think of the extra particles you produce as extra universes. So here you produce these extra particles, but you can just choose that the you can choose to look at the particular cases where you don't produce them. And for those cases, you can make some statement. So this, so therefore, the SCFT statement would be true for the particular cases where you don't produce these extra particles. Yeah. Yeah. Right, right, right. Well, it really comes from the short distance ones. So there are different ways to. I think what you are thinking about is that you are at some point here and you are seeing. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you go further and further for this one. Yeah, that's right. But okay, so you had some long distance one, but then what matters is that you continue to have them. You continue to have fluctuations as you go in the future. If you had fluctuations only up to some particular time, then you don't have this buildup. This is local buildup. You will also have this issue with the infrared divergences that you are thinking about, but that issue is definitely not present in the wave function. So the issue of the long wavelength modes is completely not present in the wave function because of this issue here. So here, for very long wavelengths, it means small k. This is perfectly finite, right? Now here, you get the infrared divergence because when you try to integrate this over, if you want to compute, for example, this in position space, you'll have to integrate over momentum. And you'll get an infrared divergence. And this comes from the long wavelength modes. So all I'm saying is that if you are evaluating the probability of a given universe, you don't get infrared divergences of long wavelength modes. But you get these other that you could call them UV divergences in the language of ADS-CFT due to short wavelength modes. But you definitely don't get the long distance ones. The long distance ones come from the fact that the wave function doesn't, for very small k, the wave function doesn't depend on the shape, right? And then when you try to integrate, you get the divergence. That's why it appears. And it's almost a gauge. It's a gauge. Most of it is a gauge artifact.
Well,
but
yeah, effectively something outside the horizon.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. If you think about it this way, that it's not present, yeah. Right? So that. Yes. No, this variance does have this infinity. Now the thing is that this is not a gauge invariant quantity. So suddenly HH is not a gauge invariant quantity. So I mean, if you computed, for example, the Weyl tensor, which is gauge invariant to linearized order, then you would get something finite. Or if you computed what? It scales different, but well, anyway, so you can compute H minus the H of the point where you observe it, right? H of X1, H of X2 minus the point where you observe it, and then you get something finite. And this is what we observe in practice, because the H at our own value, we don't know. So a constant H, so I, if we had a constant H, that's a constant metric here, which we can reabsorb in a change of coordinates. So constant H is constant metrics drop out of the equations. Yeah. Okay, so that addresses that point. Then there was another. So point one was thermalization, right? That T was different from zero, but here effectively T will go to zero in the future if you fix these boundary conditions. Okay, that was objection number one. The second is decay, but we are forbidding the decays. And if they happen, all they do is that they just contribute. I mean, the decays just will give us other factors similar to this that are local counter terms in the action. And the third one was that if you compute loop corrections, there will be IR divergences. And that is also removed by this boundary condition. So the propagator that you should use to compute these boundary conditions are propagators with fixed boundary conditions in the future. And those propagators do not lead to infrared divergences. In fact, the calculation is identical to the calculations you do in ADS because of this analytic continuation we were talking about. So I mean, you can calculate explicitly these propagators, and you see that they are from the rules of the sitter with these boundary conditions, and you see that they are analytic continuations from ADS ones, and so on. Okay, so all I'm doing here is I'm answering objections to the SCFT. That's all. My objective here was to make precise what the statement should be, why we expect it to be true from this Wheeler-DeWitt argument, why popular objections or some objections are not true. Now, of course, the biggest objection is that we don't know an example. We don't know an explicit example. But the answer to that objection is that, well, it's hard to get the sitter from string theory, so it would be hard to probably to construct an example. It must just be a technical. Well, not technical, but it must be just simply the reflection that is hard, and we are not so lucky that it's in the other cases, as in ADS in particular. Okay, so that ends the first number one, and all my talk. Okay, I'm going to, maybe I'll skip number two. Well, I'll quickly mention number two. So number two is simply computing the simplest possible three-level diagram, and which is the three-point function for gravity fluctuations. It's just this diagram like this. And one can compute it. And there are a couple of technical remarks. One is that one can describe these computations using the Spinor-Helicity formalism, even though we're not in flat space. It's convenient to, so we introduce it in a way that sounds a little artificial, but it does simplify a little bit the algebra of the stress tensor. So the in three dimensions, we have the spatial momentum k, and we define a fourth component, which is absolute value of k, and then these three-dimensional components. And as usual, we can define that lambda alpha and lambda tilde alpha. And then, so of course, we have this gravity wave, which has a given spatial momentum. And there are two transverse directions, and we characterize the, we put the polarization tensor in the two transverse directions, as usual. And then you can express the answers in terms of these lambdas and lambda tildes, as is usually the case. Now, it is convenient to think about this, to choose particular polarization tensors. Let me discuss first the case of a vector rather than a tensor as the graviton. Let's say you had a gauge field in ADS or DS. And then you can, normally you are used that in four dimensions, for example, if this has positive helicity, this you describe in terms of angle brackets of this type. So this is something that has an alpha and a beta dot index. And so this transforms in a particular way. And well, this is familiar to everyone. Yeah. Okay, this is familiar to everyone. Now, in this case, we don't have the full SL2 times SL2 symmetry, the full Lorentz symmetry, because that's broken by the time, the expansion of time. So we only have an SL2 symmetry, which is the diagonal. So this is broken to SL2 diagonal. And in order to describe these polarization tensors, it's convenient to make a choice where you choose this lambda tilde beta to be lambda beta. Okay, this is a choice that breaks the SL2 cross SL2 invariance, because I'm here mixing the dotted indices with the undotted indices. Okay. So this is doing something illegal from what you're probably most used to. This formula, probably, you think there might be a typo, probably. But that I'm saying it wrong. But well, this is a convenient way to think about this. And so you end up writing expressions like this. This is still lambda, not lambda bar. And here you have lambda contracted with lambda bar. So lambda, sorry, lambda bar contracted with lambda. And if you embed this SOD is simply the three-dimensional rotations. I should have said this around the three-dimensional slices of the expanding universe. And if you do this, then this denominator is just simply the modulus of K. It's just the zero component of K. Okay. And just simply the tensor that relates dotted and undotted indices is just simply the sigma zero component of, it's just what selects the zero component of the. Okay, this is just simple notation, and it's a convenient notation. Now this, so the fact that we have a smaller symmetry group is one difference, and the second difference with respect to the ordinary four-dimensional space is that we have momentum conservation in the spatial directions, but we don't have energy conservation when we are in the sitter. And that allows for some more structures that wouldn't be allowed in the sitter case, in the flat space. Okay, so now in flat space, you're all used to the fact, so you're all probably used to the three-point amplitudes of three gauge bosons, for example. And for example, there is the plus-plus amplitude, which is 1, 2. There are two possibilities. One is something like this. This is a possible amplitude, and another possible amplitude is something like this. Okay, so these are two possible amplitudes you could get. And if you have the non-abelian gauge theory, you only have this one. And to have this one, you will need an interaction of the form F cubed. Okay? Of course, in gravity, you have the same thing, but squared. These are two possible amplitudes. And you get this from Einstein gravity. This is in four flat dimensions. And you get this from some term that would be some higher derivative correction. Okay, so that's gravity. This is in four flat dimensions. In principle, the plus, 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 and the minus, minus, minus could have different coefficients. CPT implies that the coefficient of this guy is the complex conjugate of the coefficient of this guy. So, but that still allows for a phase that would signal some breaking of parity. So that's just flat space. Now, in AD, in de Sitter or anti-de Sitter, you get a very similar, very similar answers. And when you write them in terms of the variables I've mentioned, the final form, for example, in these cases, is just simply simply given by that divided by something which we can call the total energy, which is the sum of the three absolute values of the three momenta. So in this particular case, you get something like this. So the amplitudes have a rather simple structure. And this, they are algebraic functions of the momenta, of this absolute value of the momenta. So as a function of the three momenta, they are not analytic, but as a function of, let's say, lambdas or lambda tildes, they would be algebraic. In this case, you get rather similar answers. Now, one new, except that instead of having this simple factor, you get something a little longer that I won't write down explicitly. And there are also new ways of rewriting this, because we now don't have full momentum conservation. So in fact, this prefactor can be written in a way that is very similar to the previous one. Because now we are allowed to, and this is one convenient way to write it, for example, the plus plus minus, we can write it this way, times something. And we can also write it this way. They are equivalent. OK. Well, other points to be made is that in flat space, the Einstein action contributes only to the plus plus minus amplitude. But in the Sitter ADS, there is also a contribution to the plus plus amplitude and minus minus amplitude from the Einstein term. That's the difference. Now, that contribution, if we only had the plus plus, that we can remove the plus 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 contribution from Einstein by the addition of a local term to the wave function. So, if, okay, maybe I shouldn't go into these details. Yeah, maybe I'll skip this unless someone asks. Maybe I'll conclude there the discussion of section number two. So the point of section number two was to say that we computed these three-point amplitudes explicitly in variables which are with momentum twisters, sorry, spin or helicity formalism, the same as we ordinarily do. It simplifies the answers somewhat to do it. It doesn't simplify them as much as it does in flat space. There's a little more complicated. The final point is that there was a nice paper by Rahu that tries to propose a way of computing this higher point amplitudes by recursion. And so this could be an input to that paper. And then, but so far, well, nobody has carried it out explicitly. But that would allow you to compute, in principle, so diagrams of this form, which in the context of cosmology would be higher order corrections to the wave function of the universe. Now, all of these things, from a practical point of view, are very small and very. It would be difficult to measure these things if they were present. They would be interesting to compute to understand better what kind of wave functions inflation produces. It's theoretically interesting. I mean, if inflation happens at the high scale and so on, it might be that in, I don't know, the next 100 years we might measure the ones from gravity. But it's not certainly not something that we'll measure in the next 10 years. Oh, another point is that is important is that this three-point function, the three-point functions are essentially determined by conformal symmetry. So, in the sense that conformal symmetry, the conformal symmetry of the wave function, constrains the wave function to have these specific forms, and any theory of the sitter that includes graviton should have one of these forms. That's another important point. It could even be a string theory. It could be close to, I mean, even if you had a model of inflation where the Hubble scale was close to the string scale, where you couldn't apply classic ordinary gravity to compute it, still it should be one of these two forms. So by the two forms, I mean the one that comes from Einstein gravity. And I didn't say, but this is one that would come from, well, a Weyl cube term could produce this. And this, the ones of this type could be produced by the ordinary Einstein term. Okay, almost ran out of time. Now, okay. Oh, that's good. Well, if you want more details about this, I can mention them later. At this point, I'll conclude that discussion. And I'll go to point number three. Okay, so in point number three, we return to what we were saying in the past, the wave function of the sitter or ADS is given by evaluating certain classical solutions. Take the Einstein action, and we evaluate it on a classical solution of the Einstein action. Okay. Now, we also said that so the Einstein action has the form square root of g r minus 2 delta, right, to lambda. And let me set lambda to 1 so that I don't keep track of unnecessary constants. So there is here, there is always an overall factor like this. I won't mention it again. So now we're going to be talking about the evaluation of this action. So we are evaluating this minus some number, let's say 1. Now, in a solution of Einstein's equations, so Einstein's equations in this case is reduced to simply saying that the Ricci tensor is proportional to the metric with a coefficient that depends on, well, whether I put 1 or 2 or 3 or whatever here. So I'm not going to keep track of numerical coefficients in this discussion. So if you have, and this is called an Einstein space, so if you have an Einstein space, you put it back here, and you will get that the Einstein action reduces to the volume, but the volume is infinite. So both in ADS or the sitter cases is infinite, and that's the reason we needed to subtract from here some counter terms, so some integral of square root of g on the, so this is an integral over a four-dimensional manifold. Let me call it M4, and this is an integral over the boundary of M4. Okay, so we have some four-dimensional manifold. We fix the metric in the boundary, so that's some G3 boundary, and we solve for the metric in the bulk here, which is a function of x and eta. This is only a function of x, and we plug them in this equation. This is only a function of x. This is a function of x and eta, but here we're integrating over both x and eta. Okay, so that's what we discussed before. And now the observation, there's an interesting observation that was made by a mathematician called Anderson, and then it was extended to other dimensions by other mathematicians, Chang and Yang and one other person whose name I'm forgetting. Which is this is actually equal to the integral of Weyl squared minus the Euler character. Okay. So the statement is that the Einstein action evaluated on an Einstein space gives you the same as the integral of the Weyl squared action evaluated on the same solution, evaluated on a solution of Einstein's equations. Okay. Okay. And this is the Euler character of the space, which doesn't depend on small fluctuations. So if we are evaluating about around small fluctuations from the sitter, we can just forget about this term. Okay. Now the proof of this statement is fairly simple. It's simply the observation that if you write the Euler character, it's the integral of some Riemann squared plus Ricci squared plus Ricci scalar squared. Okay. And then Riemann can be written in terms of Weyl squared, up to terms that are also of this form, so it will continue to have this form. And then on an Einstein space, Ricci is proportional to the scalar curvature and to the metric, so all these species will be proportional to the metric, right? So essentially, this is saying that this volume that we were computing here can be expressed in terms of the Weyl, the integral of the Weyl tensor squared times the Euler character. Now, the integral of the Weyl tensor squared is something completely finite. It doesn't have the divergences, because if you have a space, let's see, erase the metric of. So we're considering metrics of this form, G, okay, then where this G is some the G at the boundary plus some small corrections, that some corrections that start in power series in eta. So this action is completely invariant under a Weyl rescaling of the metric. So if you evaluate it for G or for omega squared G, G mu nu, it gives you the same answer. So we can forget about this factor when we evaluate the Weyl square action. So that shows that it's explicitly finite. Now, this is infinite. So you might say, well, what happened here? But the point is that the Euler character on a space with a boundary needs to be, you need to add some boundary terms. And so this, so the Euler, the thing that is really topological invariant is the integral of that Ricci stuff I mentioned, plus some integral over the boundary of something that looks like a gravitational Chern-Simons term. And this one is divergent, and in precisely such a way that it accounts for those divergences that were there. So in the end of the day, the thing that is topological invariant is the same as, well, what you need what you need to write down here is exactly what you need in order to write the renormalized volume, which had to work since the divergences in both sides have to be the same. Okay. So that was one observation. So that kind of so you can wonder, well, it is a bit curious that the you can evaluate the wave function by simply this local expression in the bulk with Weyl squared. So now I'll make two observations. The first of which is well known to those who know it, which is that any Einstein space, so R mu nu, if you have a solution of Einstein's equation, then it implies that this is a solution of the equations of motion of the Weyl square action of conformal gravity. I should have mentioned that gravity with that action is called conformal gravity. Okay, it's a gravity which where the fundamental thing are the angles, not the distances. You can vary the distances because you can rescale the metric. But so the equations of motion, and this is easy to see because the equations of motion of well, okay, if you want to know why, you can ask me later. Well, maybe should I explain it? So I mentioned that up to the Euler character, Weyl squared was a bunch of Ricci tensor squares, right? Plus R plus Riemann tensor. So if you calculate the equation of motion will involve Ricci tensors and scalar curvatures and so on. So the equations of motion will contain derivatives of the Ricci tensor, will contain Ricci or Riemann tensor squares, etc. And since the whole action was conformal invariant, this whole thing, whatever it is, whatever the equation of motion is, should be traceless. Because under a variation of the metric proportional to the proportional to an overall factor, it should definitely vanish. So then if you have an Einstein space, any covariant derivative of Riemann tensors and so on will be zero. Anything that doesn't have a covariant derivative will be proportional to the metric. So this whole thing will be proportional to the metric, but I told you it had to be traceless, so it has to be zero. Okay. And you can check even more explicitly if you don't believe this argument. But I think it's really an argument. And the second is that, so now this is saying that, well, not only we're evaluating on a solution of, not only we're evaluating the action of conformal gravity, but we're evaluating the action of conformal gravity on a solution of conformal gravity. Okay. So couldn't we just forget about ordinary gravity and think that what we have in the bulk is conformal gravity? After all, we have a wave function which is supposed to be conformal invariant and so on. Wouldn't it be natural that the action in the bulk is also that of conformal gravity? And indeed, there is a way to select out of the many solutions of conformal gravity. Well, I guess I should have mentioned that. Before I discuss this point, let me say that conformal gravity in the past has been considered and it has very nice properties, like it's only divergences are logarithmic, and in fact there is a version with n equal to 4 supersymmetry where that is believed to be finite. It has appeared in various contexts, from various reasons. Most recently, I guess, from the work of Berkowitz and Witten on the twister string, they naturally got conformal gravity. It's a renormal. So that version with n equal to 4 supersymmetry is believed to be a finite theory of gravity. So it has all these nice, interesting properties, but it has a terrible problem, which is that it has ghosts. The equations of motions are fourth order, and if you try to quantize it in a way, you'll see that it has some negative norm states. Okay. So this has fourth order equations. So there will be more solutions than the solutions of ordinary gravity. So these are some of the solutions, but in addition, we have other solutions. Is there a way of removing the R solutions? And in fact, in this context, there is a simple way to remove the R solutions, and which is the following. So if we go back to this metric we had here, various people have shown, I guess starting with Starobinsky in the Sitter context, that the metric here starts at, if you expand in powers of eta, you start from some boundary value, G3, and then you solve Einstein's equation, so the equations are mu nu equal to G mu nu, and you find this as a first correction, and then eta cubed, G3, and so on. Okay. Also, Pfefferman and Graham really established this at the level of mathematical theorem, and so on. So the important point here is that there is no term that is linear in eta. Okay. So the solutions of Einstein's equations obey a very simple condition, which is simply that the derivative in the time, the first derivative in the time direction of g, is actually equal to zero. Now notice that if we are doing conformal gravity, we can forget about this denominator, and we can view this as a metric which is an expansion around flat space. So if we put a conformal field theory on the sitter and anti the sitter, it's the same as putting it on half of flat space, right? So it's roughly half of flat space with these boundary conditions. So on that flat space matrix, we put these conditions. And then the claim is that this selects solution of Einstein gravity. Okay, and the explanation is the following. So you have one boundary in the future. We have a fourth order equation. Okay, and we have two boundary conditions in the past and two boundary conditions in the future. So we have a boundary in the past. We have the boundary condition, the Banach-Davis vacuum boundary condition, or in the ADS context would be just demanding that the wave functions go to zero. So here we have, in principle, there are, when we solve the equations, there are the fourth order equations, d squared of small fluctuation. This is, you could think of this as the linearized equation around flat space, And as I mentioned before, linearizing around flat space or the Sitter space is the same. And the solutions are H equal to, you have the ordinary plane waves with positive frequencies. So for a given momentum mode K, you could have things that go like this, things that go like e to the minus ikt, right? But we remove these guys, we remove two of this. There's this, there is also t, e to the ikt. So these are the four solutions that have a fixed spatial momentum. Okay? And so these two are removed by the boundary conditions in the past. Okay, and in the future, you this thing imposes one condition, one relationship between the two. So there will be one condition. And we know that, so therefore there will be one solution. So with these two boundary, with the boundary condition that we have this, and that at the boundary at t equal to 0, this is the specific metric G3 that we want on the boundary, then we'll have one solution of conformal gravity. But we know that Einstein gravity gives us the one solution that obeys this boundary condition. Therefore, that's also the solution of conformal gravity. Okay, so right. So the final conclusion of this discussion is that yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know how to turn it to that. So this looks very similar to what we do in electrodynamics, where when we evaluate, let's say, an amplitude, we evaluate it on, let's say, physical states with physical polarizations, but not, let's say, with A0 polarized, with G mu, If we have a gauge field, so we don't put the zero component of Z, for example. And in that case, we know that there is some other state, the longitudinal one, that will cancel this one if you compute it into loops and so on. I don't know if you could do that in, certainly not in bosonic gravity, because you don't have other states that you could cancel with. You can ask whether in n equal to 4, in n equal to 4 conformal supergravity, whether you could do it. But then you would have to have a cancellation between states of different spins. And that is certainly not what happens here. So what happens here is that from the spatial point of view, both have the same helicity, helicity 0. This and the longitudinal mode both have helicity 0. And I think that this has to be the case, because the spin is something physical you could measure. And if something is going to cancel something else, it should have the same helicity. Now, you could, so I don't know whether in conformal, so certainly even in conformal supergravity, you don't have other modes of the same helicity. So the only helicity 2 fields are the graviton and the ghost partner, so the one that has negative norm. So these four solutions, so here I mentioned these four solutions, so you really get two helicity 2 modes, and one combination has positive norm and the other combination has negative norm. And if you want them to have positive energy, so if you choose the quantization where they have positive energy, then one has. And I don't know how to cancel them in loops, if they can or cannot. So for the moment, I'm just only making this statement at the level of classical solutions, or if you wish, at the level of tree diagrams. I don't know if there, of course, if there was a way to extend it to loops, it would be extremely interesting. And that's the reason I was initially interested in this. I'm a little now more negative that it can be done, but maybe it can be done. I don't know whether it cannot be done. It would be very exciting if it could be done, because it means that you could make a finite theory of gravity and so on. But so in some sense, the extension to loops would be the most interesting part. But even at the level of tree diagrams, I think it's it's an interesting statement, and it might lead to some, calculational simplicity. So, because if you, Actually, if you were imagining doing a computation here, you would find that the propagators would be different than the ones of Einstein gravity. So because it's only the same, that the wave function here is the same, but the propagators in the middle and so on would be different. It might be a better gauge to do the calculation. Suddenly, it would be a way of doing the calculation where everything in the bulk would look like it's finite, these properties that Swinburne and Johansson, Carrasco found for ordinary gravity. Maybe they are similar. Well, here it's manifest. So here, if you do these three-level diagrams, it's completely manifest. Yeah, so conformal gravity on hyperbolic. Yeah, everything I said here is the same in the sitter or hyperbolic space. The two are the same. They are related simply by that analytic continuation. And in fact, at some point I mentioned there was a change in the radius, or a change. That change in the radius could also be viewed as a change in the overall Planck constant. And so the only difference between the two cases is just the sign, so the action is c times integral w squared, right? So that the sitter case will have a positive c, and the anti-sitter, Euclidean anti-sitter, a negative c. Now I should mention also that this corresponds to, I mentioned that analytic continuation between the sitter and Euclidean anti-sitter, and it looked a little bit strange, and maybe I don't know if it looked natural, then what I'm going to say is not necessary. But from the point of view of conformal gravity, that's totally obvious. I mean, that's simply that we have in the sitter, we have conformal gravity in Minkowski space, or half of Minkowski space. And we can, of course, consider the analytic continuation to Euclidean space. And we would have conformal gravity in Euclidean space. It's just simply that. And if you just do that, then you get the Euclidean version of that, and with the corresponding value of C that corresponds to the Euclidean continuation. Okay, you don't need to do the analytic continuation of C. Now, if you do it in hyperbolic space, then you get the opposite sign. In some sense, when you do the sitter one, you get the right sign of C here. And when you do the anti-sitter one, you get the opposite sign, the opposite. Then. By the opposite, I mean that if you did this in Euclidean gravity, right? So from the point of view of Euclidean gravity, this is a very nice action, because with the right sign of C, it's positive definite. Now, the one you get from Euclidean space is the opposite one. But at the level of three diagrams that we were discussing, it's all of this is irrelevant. I mean, it's you have to keep track of the sign, but whether the sign is positive or negative doesn't matter. Now, you might think, oh, maybe you made a mistake with the sign. So let me point out why the sign is the way it is. So I mentioned in the very beginning that the wave function was e to the minus, so for the case of the sitter, e to the minus some constant c, which was, well, this constant here is just m Planck squared over times r squared. So some constant which is positive times h squared times something positive. So in the sitter case, you have to have something like this to have a normalizable wave function. When we integrate over h to suppress the large fluctuations, we need this to be positive, right? If you had a hypothetical conformal field theory which is dual to this, the two-point function as a stress tensor is simply the derivative with respect to the metric of this wave function, evaluated when the metric is 1. So if you take two derivatives of this, you get something which is negative, okay? So this is saying this two-point function, that it would be dual to the sitter, would have that coefficient negative. Now, okay, that was the sitter. Now, in Euclidean ADS, in the ordinary case of ordinary ADS CFT, the same thing, we know the two-point function should be positive, right? And therefore, this wave function is something that should have a plus here, constant some h squared, okay? It has the opposite sign. Okay, so that's this sign. Let me see. Well, I think I said more or less what I wanted to say about this. So the point here, let me summarize it in an equation. So the statement was that if you calculate the wave function of conformal gravity as a function of the metric, and its first derivative, which is another function of the metric. Now, normally, the first derivative is the momentum conjugate to the metric, and you don't evaluate the wave function as a function of p and q. But since this is a fourth order equation, you can evaluate it as a function of the metric and its first derivative. So this is something. But if you set this equal to 0, then that is equal to the wave function of ordinary gravity, so of Einstein gravity, what I was calling renormalized action of Einstein, as a function of this three metric. Okay. And here there is a limit in modeling going to the future of the Sitter space. And this translates into, this statement is true in perturbation theory, so it translates into an identity of Feynman diagrams of this sort, three-level Feynman diagrams that are computed either, you can compute them either in with the conformal gravity propagator, or you can compute them with the ordinary Einstein gravity propagator in the Sitter space. I should mention this also kind of explains, if you wish, why. Good. So the Planck scale. We're it's really deeply ingrained in us that gravity is a theory with a scale. Okay, and this is true. However, when we put this theory with a scale in a space which also has a scale, like the Sitter space, there's only one dimensionless constant, which is the ratio of the Planck scale divided by the Hubble scale. And that was appearing in all the classical formulas. And so that's a simple dimensionless number. And that is the number that appears here in front, is the coupling constant of conformal gravity. So conformal gravity, we can use the three-level approximation if this coupling constant is large. Now, since you asked this, let me make a side comment, which, this is a wild speculation, probably. It turns out that in the case of n equal to 4 superconformal gravity, it turns out that that theory contains a massless field that could be multiplying here the constants here. This it's a little bit like Liouville theory in two dimensions. So there's a mass. There's a you can multiply this whole action by a function of a massless field. And for the particular case of the conformal gravity that comes from twister strings, Berkowitz and Witten have argued that this looks like e to the 2c, or e to the c, let's say. Okay, let me say e to the minus c. Well, let me say e to the c. Okay, e to the c, some scalar field. So now you're used to the fact that in Einstein gravity we can remove this. We can remove something that multiplies the curvature by just doing a rescaling. But here, since this piece was rescaling invariant, we cannot remove it. And in fact, we just discussed that the overall constant sets the coupling. So in this theory has no coupling, and this coupling is given by the VEV of this field. And you could imagine that making a VEV here, which, I don't know, it has a moderate value, like the log of 10 to the 120, that would set the ratio between the cosmological constant and the Planck scale. So there could be a sort of dimensional transmutation argument that would, or an exponential. It's the usual theorist trick of taking large scale and put it into the exponent. Now, of course, this is I'm not claiming this will solve the cosmological constant problem, but it's only an interesting, at least in the context of this n equal to 4 superconformal gravity, is an interesting issue. Now, the reason it doesn't solve it is because in nature we don't have only two scales, the cosmological constant and the Planck scale. If we only had these two, that would be fine. But we have, as you know, many other scales. Okay.